Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, returning for another installment of madness as we journey beneath the surface of one of the more baffling cases of the last decade, the disappearance of 34-year-old wife and mother of two, Sherry Papini. Now, just a quick note here. I'm putting something together for Patreon supporters. It's been a while since I did something like that, so we're going to be answering questions and doing shout-outs and things of that nature. So if you've been supporting me on Patreon, thank you very much. Appreciate it, and I've fallen a bit behind in that, and I'm going to try to catch up now. So again, thank you, and let's get going with the episode here. On the morning of November 2nd, 2016, Sherry dropped her kids off at daycare near their home in Redding, California, a small rural community located about 2.5 hours north of Sacramento, while her husband, Keith, went to work as some type of manager of the Geek Squad at Best Buy. Shortly before 11 a.m., Sherry texted Keith and asked if he'd be coming home for lunch. Keith's job apparently took him to the homes of various customers in the region, so I assume he might have stopped home on his lunch break on days when he worked close to the house. But on this day, he declined. He wouldn't have time. And that was their last contact. So Keith gets home in the early evening and sees his wife's vehicle is there. But when he goes inside, Sherry is nowhere to be found. Worse, his kids aren't home either. Sherry normally picked them up at daycare between 4:30 and 4:45 p.m., though she never arrived that afternoon. There's no evidence in the home to suggest something sinister happened, but Keith does find a partially wrapped gift that seems as though it was abandoned at some point in the process of wrapping. Now, Keith learns the kids are safe at the daycare and plans to go pick them up, but in the meantime, he uses a Find My iPhone app to try to locate Sherry, assuming she has possession of her phone. Now, again, this is a rural location, to a certain extent, so they have this really long driveway that stretches about a mile from the home to the intersection of two roads where the local residents' mailboxes sit. The app tells Keith that Sherry's phone is there, so he goes searching for it and finds it in the grass on the side of the road. The phone is lying out in the open, face up, and with Sherry's earbuds coiled neatly on top. Stuck in the earbuds are strands of Sherry's blonde hair, as reported by her husband in the 911 call. Now, he also supposedly took a photo of those items before picking them up, and likely because the fact that they were lying on the ground on the side of the road suggested the possibility Sherry could have been abducted. There's nothing too suspicious about the call in my estimation. Keith doesn't seem to be evasive, and his presentation appears authentic. There are many people who questioned whether or not he had some type of involvement in his wife's disappearance, but we're going to learn there was no malice on his part. Keith submitted to a polygraph and was deemed to be telling the truth. In addition, the GPS on his work vehicle suggested his whereabouts could be verified throughout the day. So, not long after this case begins, we learn the husband didn't do it. If Sherry was abducted, and perhaps the victim of sexual assault and or murder, the assailant wasn't obvious. Was it a stranger? Perhaps a lover? No one could answer that question. So what appears to have happened, at a surface-level observation, is that Sherry, who had recently started running again, or jogging, was abducted in the process of that day's run when she passed the area near the mailboxes by the end of the driveway. To the best we can ascertain, somebody grabbed her, ripped out her earbuds, and left them and the phone at the scene as Sherry was taken by force. Given the terrain, we'd have to assume a vehicle was involved in the abduction. Now, Keith left the house just before 7 a.m. He received the text from Sherry about lunch close to 11 a.m., but didn't reply until after 1:30 p.m. because he apparently didn't have his personal phone on him at the time and didn't see the message. Sherry didn't have any known enemies, or even a stalker of which she was aware. If she was taken by force, the responsible party seems to be a stranger. Now, whatever happened to her occurred between the time she last texted Keith before 11 a.m. and when she would normally pick up the kids from daycare at 4:45. That's a large window of time, but we do have witnesses to assist our assessment. So, that morning, Sherry was spotted at an eyebrow salon at the Mount Shasta Mall. And while most would glaze right over this detail as insignificant, I'm screaming it in your face right now. Please remember this, because it plays into the psychology. Afterward, Sherry also went to a Michael's craft store. And this is a detail that's going to reward us with some rays of light peeking through the clouds. We know that some of the items purchased at Michael's were found at the Papini home that day, but not all of them. So ask yourself where the items could have gone. We can see some problems with logic rising to the surface of this thing already. The strands of hair in the earbuds seem to suggest they were ripped off her head, as though she was listening to music, or a podcast, when she was assaulted, and was thereby ignorant of the attacker. At 5'3" tall, and 100 pounds, it would have left her vulnerable. Of course, if you're the attacker, and don't want to do anything with the phone for the obvious problem of GPS tracking, then of course you're going to toss it. But the phone wasn't tossed. If the earbuds are coiled neatly on top, then what would have to transpire is that the attacker ripped the earbuds out, taking a few strands of hair along the way, and then got control of Sherry before neatly wrapping the earbuds back up and placing them on top of the phone on the ground. The phone couldn't have been tossed aside, because then the earbuds wouldn't be coiled neatly on top. They would unravel. What this behavior suggests, meaning the coiling of the earbuds and careful placement of the phone on the ground, is whomever put them there wanted to preserve them for future use. Ripping out the earbuds and carefully coiling them are contradictory actions. But here's what differentiates the two. The strands of hair being found in the earbuds attempts to create the perception they were ripped off Sherry's head. We don't know that's true. But the phone being found face up, undamaged, with the earbuds coiled on top, proving preservation was intended, is a fact. We see it. What that says is the phone and earbuds being preserved indicates truth, while the earbuds being ripped out is what we're being manipulated into believing. Now, look at how this goes down. Who finds the phone? Keith. He's a tech guy. It's obvious his first course of action is going to be to use this app to find his wife. So, this phone isn't being left for the cops to find. It's being left there for Keith. It does get preserved, and quickly too, along with the earbuds. But what's less obvious, or easy to predict, is that Keith would take a photo of the earbuds and phone before picking them up. I think most people, if they found a spouse's phone on the ground near their mailbox, would simply pick it up, especially if the earbuds are coiled neatly on top and the phone is undamaged. If you're Keith, and you see those items neatly sitting there, it won't look like a struggle. That is, until you pick up the items and realize there's hair in the earbuds to suggest it. In the 911 call, Keith says he thought Sherry might have gotten snatched when he saw those strands of hair because it appeared somebody ripped the earbuds off her head. That was the tipping point for his belief. The perception, not the fact. The phone and earbuds lying there didn't convince him. It was the strands of hair. And again, the strands of hair don't correlate to any facts here. They serve perception. That means someone created a perception about the event contrary to the truth. So let's keep that in mind as we proceed. Now, we do have a few witnesses in the local area that morning. At 9 a.m., one neighbor suggests he saw Sherry alone near the mailboxes, while another neighbor also claims to have seen her there, yet says it was more like 11 a.m. And then Sherry was spotted by a crew working on trees near her home. They placed this account somewhere around 2 p.m. that day. So if something nefarious went down, it seems to have occurred between 2 p.m. and 4:45 p.m. when Sherry would have been responsible for picking up the kids. There was no sign of a struggle back at the house, nor was anything missing in terms of material items. Sherry's keys to her vehicle, her purse, and ATM or credit cards were all present in the home. She didn't appear to have run away. The only item of note, again, is the partially wrapped gift. It was an American flag pillow intended for Keith as a Christmas present. But why is it partially wrapped? That seems quite odd. Wrapping a single gift requires a few cuts with scissors, at most, along with applying a few pieces of tape. It's definitely not something that takes a significant period of time, to an extent that you'd walk away from it to take a break. Sure, the phone might ring, and you ignore the gift while talking, but you go back to it afterward and finish. But now, look what it makes us do. Speculate. In the same way the phone and earbuds suggested something interrupted Sherry's run, preventing her from finishing, the partially wrapped gift offers us the same. We have to speculate about the potential interference involved in both situations. If Sherry is missing and seems to have been in the middle of a run at the time, then somebody took her. Likewise, if Sherry is missing and the gift is abandoned in the process of wrapping, it appears something prevented her from completing the task. Now, if you were to fabricate an abduction, you'd want to pick one perception or the other, right? If you make the scene appear as though you were abducted at the mailbox, why in the world would you do the same thing at the house? Those ideas are contradictory. Well, if your phone and earbuds are a mile away from your home at the mailboxes on the side of the road, and you've created a perception that you were abducted while running, then the evidence collected thereafter should confirm it. But it doesn't. Tracking dogs are brought in, and they don't detect Sherry's scent traveling from her home to the mailboxes. It doesn't appear that she was running. But even if you come to that conclusion, look what's left. The partially wrapped gift. It says she could have been taken from the house, which negates the need to prove she ran from home on a jog, at which point she got abducted by someone. In this circumstance, if Sherry never returns, it still seems like a legitimate abduction. So, what we should notice here is that the importance of how things appear is key to the success of this narrative being believable, rather than the presence of fact. We're being afforded a narrative based in perception. It lacks proper authenticity. Yes, Sherry is missing, but there is no evidence of an intruder being in the home, nor is there anything factual to prove she was abducted while out on her run. But we need to correlate the partially wrapped gift and abduction while running. The results are revealing if you piece together a psychological narrative from that. Now, let's return to that gift for a moment. The psychology of it is fascinating. If we can't identify a legitimate physical narrative for these events, then we should go deep into the emotional symbolism apparent at the crime scene. So as I said, the earbuds and phone were left in a manner suggesting the owner was preserving them, thereby saying she would return. The pillow says a lot about why Sherry disappeared. I don't know, but I assume the American flag pillow Sherry left partially wrapped was one of the items purchased at Michael's earlier that day. If the pillow is partially wrapped, here's what it says on the surface in terms of the visual value it would offer when Keith discovered it later that day. When Sherry had disappeared, she was in the middle of thinking about him. Their love got interrupted by some type of awful event. It could have even happened in the house. It's possible she was assaulted while wrapping that gift. She didn't try very hard to sell the kidnapping with the way the phone and earbuds were left out on the road, so we shouldn't expect an extraordinary effort inside the house either, if that's the case. So at face value, what we see, in terms of perception, is that Sherry was thinking about Keith when she disappeared. She bought him a gift. But let's look deeper at the gift. It was meant for Sherry, but not on a physical level. It represented an emotional need for her. Pillows are used in many ways, but for one reason. Comfort. The American flag has traditionally represented freedom. And while I recognize there are people who don't necessarily believe that, Sherry and Keith live in a very traditional conservative, and religious community and come from that type of background, so I think they would be likely to embrace such an ideal. I mean, just the fact that Sherry bought it for Keith suggests it's something he would appreciate, so that answers itself. Now, this pillow represents the gift of comfort and freedom. But let's go deeper to get clarity. The stuffing of the pillow is on the inside, of course. That represents the comfort or emotional aspect Sherry seeks to find. The American flag is on the exterior of the pillow. That represents the freedom she wants, or the physical aspect. Now, we know Sherry is trying to create a perception the gift is for Keith, but the gift is really representative of her desires. She wants the comfort of freedom. Sherry Papini wants to escape her life. Now, if you were going to run away from your life, how might that desire manifest in the physical world? You might run. So, Sherry goes for a jog and disappears. But watch what happens along the way here. The place to which she runs, and where she gets abducted, is an intersection, a literal crossroads. That's the place from which she disappears, because that's where she was in life, specifically in her head. She sought the comfort of freedom by running away. But the abduction exists, along with the phone and earbuds being neatly placed on the ground, because she intends to come back at some point. And that happens. She preserves the opportunity to return the same way she preserves the phone. If Sherry blames her harmful actions on someone else, then they won't be her fault. So, we get the abductors. She fabricates the disappearance to seem as though it's someone else's fault. To me, this is indicative of being a product of mental illness. To be fair, then, we have to ask if Sherry has a history of doing anything like that before. Of course, in 2003, her mother contacted the police to report Sherry was harming herself and blaming it on her mother. You'd have to imagine how concerned a mother would have to be to call the police. It sounds serious. Yet, we're generally told there's no history of mental illness. So, if she was doing this all the way back in 2003, and perhaps even before, and it went untreated, to the extent she has no documented history of mental illness, then it would be fair to say the problem likely would have been exacerbated by lack of treatment over the years. Look what happens. The proof is in the pudding. But we shouldn't judge too soon. Let's examine how this plays out. Sherry's family believes she was abducted while running, while the police don't think there's enough evidence to assert that happened. They seem to be on the fence, or at least open-minded, about whether or not Sherry disappeared voluntarily or as the result of a malicious abduction. What we do know is that there was no activity in Sherry's bank accounts, nor was there any communication left on her phone that might have suggested where she went. Everybody is left to speculate. So, Sherry is missing. Some of the items she purchased at Michael's that morning are gone as well. But we're being told she was abducted while out running in preparation for an upcoming race in which numerous family members plan to participate. So, if she went running, even if she only made it 1 mile to the mailboxes at the end of the driveway, it wouldn't be reasonable to say she took the items with her. You wouldn't go jogging holding a bag of stuff you bought at a retail store that morning. But the items are missing, and we have no explanation for them. So, in accordance with those missing items not being something you'd take out on a run, we now understand why the dogs can't find Sherry's scent on the path to the mailboxes. The sheriff even said the conditions were very favorable for the dogs to track her. And let's remember, we have point A and point B here. For instance, in a case like the disappearance of Mara Murray, the last known sighting of her was at her car. We only have point A. There was no trace of her discovered elsewhere, and so the police, and by extension the dogs, didn't have the ability to confirm if they were trying to track her in the direction she actually went. But in this case, we know Sherry had to leave home, whether by force or of her own volition, and that the path she took in doing so went past the area where the mailboxes reside at the culmination of the driveway. If Sherry was abducted from her home, seemingly in the process of wrapping that gift, whether she was grabbed or even abandoned the gift as she went outside after hearing or seeing something strange, then the means by which she traveled would almost certainly be a vehicle. In that case, the kidnapper would likely have been the person to ditch the earbuds and phone, and by way of tossing them out the window. Yet, they're found neatly on the ground. They weren't thrown. They were placed there. So if the kidnapper took Sherry from her home, then either that person or Sherry got out of the vehicle and placed them on the side of the road. But if she was abducted from home, why wouldn't the kidnapper just leave her phone and earbuds there? Her vehicle was there. Her purse was there. The best you could hope to achieve in terms of redirecting light is to convince people investigating the matter afterward that the abduction took place by the mailboxes rather than inside the house. It would still appear to be an abduction. You can't negate that. Again, we have no sign of a struggle inside the home. Nothing is missing, except some of the items on the Michaels receipt. Regardless of the scenario, the only thing the abductor wanted was Sherry. It's clear. If she was taken while jogging, they didn't even want her phone for the purpose of resale. If she was taken from home, they didn't even seek any cash from her purse, or any other valuables either, for that matter. In this type of scenario, we should expect to learn the assailant is an adult male and the motive is sexual in nature. Those instances often end in murder as a means of concealing the perpetrator's guilt. Yet, somehow, this is perceived as a situation in which Sherry would still be alive, held captive somewhere, and that a demand for ransom might be on the horizon. Accordingly, it's announced the Papini family has not only set up a GoFundMe page to raise money for the purpose of hiring a private investigator, but also now has an anonymous donor backing them with a significant amount of cash. Apparently, the family felt that law enforcement wasn't making enough strides in the case, thus the quick movement toward trying to hire somebody else to investigate. Yet, the issue isn't law enforcement. The problem is that these circumstances fail to prove organic. The narrative of Sherry getting abducted while jogging simply does not work, nor does the assertion that she might have been abducted at home. Neither is likely. The psychology of the evidence at play suggests the perceptions we're being afforded have been manipulated by somebody. But a kidnapper doesn't leave a scene that seems to have been manipulated to appear as though someone was abducted. The person truly was abducted. The situation would form naturally, and so the evidence left in the wake of that event should tell us the same. Now, the kidnapper might attempt to make the disappearance seem voluntary, as though there was no abduction, to avoid detection, but a kidnapper does not create the facade of a kidnapping when one is actually taking place. The bottom line is this. The logic employed in the creation of this event has been crafted by somebody. The supposed victim does not appear to have reacted to it. She appears to have created it. And where was Sherry Papini right before she disappeared? Michael's, a craft store. It seems to be where the pillow was bought. Other items are missing. And what is the catchy slogan Michaels uses? Make creativity happen. That's what Sherry Papini did. She crafted this narrative. She made it happen. She created it. Now, I'm just some idiot, and certainly not an investigator of any kind, but this would have been my immediate thought upon examining the available evidence. This story is fabricated, a product of Sherry's emotional desire to escape to freedom, manifesting in the material world, for lack of finding an emotional solution. But like I said earlier, the theme of preservation, found in the way the phone and earbuds are left, suggests she's coming back. We know it will happen. But here's what's so interesting about how it will transpire. If Sherry is falsifying a kidnapping and plans to return, in order to do so, she'll have to utilize the same emotional narrative she employed in the fabrication of the one she used to leave. It's unavoidable, unless she mirrors the exact logic she created in leaving for the purpose of her return, this plot will fail. Now, I don't know if she left with the conscious awareness she'd be coming back, or if the placement of the earbuds and phone was simply symbolic of the fact she knew this absence wasn't permanent. But either way, there's no sign of Sherry for 3 weeks. Her family is devastated, of course. Her husband and children miss their wife and mother. It's really sad. Yet, 3 weeks later, in the early morning hours of Thanksgiving Day, November 24th, 2016, Sherry Papini reappears with a horrifying story of being held captive. Now, before we examine her claims, let's review the psychological narrative afforded by the evidence in her disappearance. We'll compare it to her return. Sherry wanted to give herself the gift of comfort by way of freedom, symbolized by the American flag pillow, so she broke free, or ran away, symbolized by her jog, from the place she was being held captive, her home, which symbolizes her head, because she's at a crossroads in life. The emotional problem manifested in reality. So in return, she'll have no choice but to craft a narrative in which the same thing happens. Yet this time, it will occur in the context of getting back to her family. Now, we know Sherry wanted to break free from her emotional issue, and that's why she ran. She was feeling as though she'd been held captive in her own mind. So wherever she is at this time, she'll need to tell us that she was being held captive, and it has to manifest in the structure of a house because she suffered the issue at her own home to begin with. Her home is equivalent to her head, or brain. Now, when she left, according to the fabricated narrative, she did so in a manner that involved running, and then being abducted by somebody in a vehicle on the side of a road. So, when she returns, as I said before, she'll have to mirror that value, meaning she'll need to be released from a vehicle near some type of crossroads or intersection, at which point she'll run. That will put her in a place where she attempts to contact loved ones at home and police instead of severing that contact by way of leaving the phone. Plus, rather than leaving with items from the craft store, she'll return with items crafted for a purpose of legitimizing her story. So let's document her return now. The first thing I want to say about that is that our protagonist should have an external want or desire in addition to an internal or emotional need that play out simultaneously as one battles to defeat the other. The want should be the thing that springs the protagonist into action. It spurs her choice to enter the new and unfamiliar world to get it. But beneath that, she should also have an emotional need that slowly becomes apparent in her pursuit of the want. Having learned the lesson about what she needs by way of experiencing all the pitfalls of getting what she wants, the protagonist returns home a changed person. Now, we need to examine Sherry more deeply for clarity. She didn't seem to have any type of a breakdown, nor did she seem psychotic. So I think what set her off was something more practical. In that light, we need to look for evidence of that in the psychology of the story she tells us. Now, I think the thing Sherry wants relates to a man. It's said she texted with a man from Michigan for months prior to her disappearance, and that he was in California for at least several days before and after the time she disappeared. Sherry's family, of course, say she would never leave her children, but I believe she planned to go and not return. I think the comfort by way of freedom that she was seeking by running away was the life of a single woman free to go on adventures with this guy. I think she felt trapped in the role of a wife and mother and wanted to escape the responsibility. But it's not hard to see she had a pretty good life, and I think she realized that, if only too late for her own good. She had to sell the kidnapping. She had no choice. That was the only way she could return after leaving like that. I think she met with this man, and they spent a few days together, or even a week, keeping a low profile, and she became overwhelmed with guilt and remorse, so she canceled the plans with him, and subsequently, he left to go back to Michigan. I think she spent the remainder of the time, in isolation, preparing her appearance to be perceived as consistent with an abduction victim. In the end, she wanted to go home, having learned her lesson about what she needs in relation to what she wants. But what would drive her to want to do that? Let's look at why that would happen from an emotional standpoint. What was she suffering? Again, clearly the restrictive nature of a married life with kids was part of the issue, as it reduces personal freedom. But there's something lurking beneath that. Sherry was 34 years old, which is revealing to a certain extent when placed in context with the abductors she chooses. When you're 30, 32, or even 34, you tend to view yourself, even if increasingly less so over that time, as an older version of your young self. But as you cross the threshold of 35 and beyond, the perception starts to shift. You see yourself as a young version of your old self. That's sometimes the cocktail that ignites a midlife crisis. The hourglass is draining. And so, here we have Sherry in the twilight of what could be considered her prime physical years. This is her second marriage, so it stands to reason she probably didn't spend a lot of time being single and going on adventures with other men. She might have missed out on those things to a certain extent and panicked that she made the wrong choices in life. She wanted to escape, but ultimately realized the ship had sailed on her opportunity. This mess she'd gotten herself in needed to be undone. So we should see that emotional crisis is apparent in her choice of villains as it pertains to her age and becoming an older woman who no longer has a chance at freedom. Now, we find Sherry running across a parking lot on security camera footage early Thanksgiving morning at about 4:15 a.m. when it's still dark. We know she has to go to an intersection or crossroads, and she does. She goes to the place where the road she's on meets the I-5 freeway. We know she has to claim she came from a house where she was imprisoned. She does that. In addition, that manifests in her having a chain around her waist, one hand zip-tied to it, and clasps on her ankles. It has to be apparent she was imprisoned and broke free. She also had a bag on her head, but took it off when released. That was what she used to flag down a driver. Now, we're told the following is how the abduction went down to begin with. Sherry was out for a jog wearing her earbuds and got forcefully abducted by two Latina women with their faces covered. They put her in a dark SUV and drove off. Okay, so notice the choice of two women. It's the least likely scenario, meaning Sherry is far more likely to get abducted by a man for sexual purposes resulting in murder than being abducted by two women for reasons we never come to understand. And we never get clarity on that situation because women generally don't kidnap each other, and if and when it does happen, there's a reason. But here's what the choice of utilizing women does for her. it negates the possibility of sexual assault by a man, and therefore, no one will be attempting to collect a rape kit. If, in fact, she did run away to be with a man, sex likely occurred. She confirms there was no sexual assault. So, Sherry can protect that aspect of the narrative by using women in her story. But in doing so, she's not ever able to offer any type of reason she was abducted. We don't understand the motive. She isn't able to provide a description of where she was held, or even offer the same for the SUV the women used. Furthermore, she says they spoke in Spanish most of the time, so she had no idea what was said. Sherry couldn't identify their faces, saying they were covered. But here's the description she provides for the women. It's quite revealing in relation to her own age and how this situation plays out. Sherry says the first woman was 20 to 30 years old, and that the second woman was 40 to 50 years old. Sherry's age lies right in the middle of that. And guess what feature differentiates these women? The younger one has thin, well-maintained eyebrows, while the older one has big, bushy eyebrows. And where did Sherry go the morning of her disappearance? An eyebrow salon. Of course, what's the most common form of maintenance on eyebrows? Thinning, or shaping. So, Sherry sees herself as once being the younger woman, and watching it slip away as she heads toward being the older woman. That's the thing she really can't escape. That's the reason for her realization and returning. Having her eyebrows done, in the context of these two villains, means she is actively trying to fend off the older woman. She wants freedom from becoming that person. So, we'll need to see that play out in her story. The younger woman will need to defeat the older woman and set Sherry free from the shackles of being stuck in that fate. So let's take a look at her story now. This is what she tells us happened. After being imprisoned for 3 weeks, she heard an argument between the younger woman and the older woman, which was followed by a gunshot. At that point, the younger woman enters the room where Sherry is and takes her out to the SUV. She drives Sherry to the intersection by the freeway and sets her free. So let's examine the emotional implications of that part of the story. As I said, Sherry, in terms of age and resulting life experience, lies right between the younger woman and older woman who have taken her captive inside this home. At 34, and already tied down with her second marriage and two kids, Sherry feels time and circumstance have rendered a situation where she's leaving the younger woman she's been behind, along with accompanying freedom it offers, in order to assume the role of an aging woman whose freedom will continue to be restricted. Her desire is to escape that fate, to be freed by the younger woman she once was. The man she was meeting to take her away from it all acted as a conduit for that in her disappearance. But since the abduction is fabricated, then, in her return, the emotional narrative has to say that she wanted to be taken away from the imprisonment of aging into this older woman by way of her younger self at this home where she's allegedly being confined. Accordingly, Sherry tells us that after an argument between the younger and older women imprisoning her, there was a gunshot and the younger woman emerged. There's no indication the older woman is still alive. We have to assume the younger woman killed the older woman, and since the younger woman then goes on to free Sherry, we also have to assume the argument was in relation to keeping Sherry there, or not. And if that was the argument, and the loser is the older woman who dies, then her death by the hands of the younger woman says Sherry wanted to escape the indefinite imprisonment of becoming that aging woman who offered no freedom. Sherry wanted to be the younger woman again, to go back to her youth. So it manifested in her story in a manner that shows she symbolically tried to kill the future of her aging into the older woman who had no freedom, instead choosing to go back to being the younger woman who still wanted to be free and escape that fate of imprisonment. The older abductor, aka her older self, is eliminated while trying to uphold the imprisonment that will keep Sherry there forever, while the younger woman, aka her younger self, kills the older self, freeing Sherry and saving her from that fate. Sherry then runs back to the crossroads, the intersection in her life, represented by the entrance ramp from the road she's on to I-5, and returns, understanding the emotional issue can't be reconciled in the physical world. She's going to age. Her marriage is a lifetime commitment, and she has to be there to raise her kids. That's what she needs. But what she desired, what she wanted, was to be young and free again. To a certain extent, I think we all do. Yet, we can't reconcile that desire with our reality. Sherry tried to transcend her emotional issue through physical means. It failed. You can't run toward the past. It's gone. You can only run toward the future. She was hoping to be freed by her younger self, escaping the fate of the older woman. But sometimes, what we learn is that the prison we live in is our only freedom. If Sherry ran away, she would always be running, and the thing from which she was trying to escape would always be right on her heels, ready to take her by force. It would catch up and snatch her. That's the reason for the abduction. She couldn't escape the thought of being trapped between the freedom of her younger self and the confinement of the family life she'd chosen, aging into the next phase of her existence. The emotional crisis is articulated in the psychology of the event, rather than explicitly, because she had to fabricate an abduction to run away. The emotional truth is clearly embedded in the logic present in the kidnapping story. Now, Sherry chose two Latina women whose faces were covered for a couple of reasons. They need to be the bad guys, so to speak, so Sherry will have to project that identity upon them with her own personal feelings. While the family rejects the notion that Sherry was a racist, a blog post on a defunct website from 2003 called skinheads.com came to light and said differently. She would have been in her early 20s back then. Supposedly the post, which is written with the author's maiden name of Sherry Graff, makes disparaging remarks about Latinos, including insensitivity in relation to immigration, among other things. Now, that doesn't necessarily tell us a lot, but it's enough to believe she might be inclined to use Latino women as the perpetrators for this reason. The real bad guy is her. That's why she says their faces were covered. It's really her. She can't give a physical description of herself, so she projects something she perceives as evil or undesirable onto the palette. But in reality, these two women are both her. One is her younger self, and the other is her older self. The older self, as it does in reality, tries to keep her in prison, while her younger self aims to free her. In a narrative you'd find in a film, the protagonist would have to face her shadow and defeat it. In relation to this story, that means the younger woman would have to face the older woman and defeat her. Of course, that happens, but only in the fabricated kidnapping. The younger woman shoots the older one to free Sherry and prevent the fate of being imprisoned in an awful place for the rest of her life. But the lesson Sherry learns is that there is no escaping the process of becoming that older woman. You can't kill that reality. It has to be reconciled through one thing. Change. You have to embrace change because it's going to happen anyway. That's what I mean about the prison in which you live being the only freedom you'll ever know. If Sherry must exist behind the bars of a small cell called the human condition, specifically the pitfalls of mortality, as she ages into that older woman, then there's no better way to do it than to embrace the love of family waiting at home. Now, Sherry, of course, is rescued and taken to the hospital, but she's not without injuries. We don't have access to photos depicting the nature or extent of the harm that befell her, but as it was relayed by her husband, Keith, her condition was quite poor. We're told Sherry's hair had been hacked off at the shoulders, and she had markings all over her ankles, wrists, and other places from being bound. He says the bridge of her nose is broken, and her weight has dropped from 100 pounds to 87 pounds. He also reports scabbing, and as though that isn't enough, Sherry was branded. Something was branded on her shoulder, and I find this occurrence revealing, to say the least. We don't have an image of the brand, or even a sketch depicting the design, but we're told it's ambiguous in nature. Police don't know what it is. Now, they're not suggesting that they can clearly see the marking, but don't know how it translates. What they're saying is the marking itself, the letters, are ambiguous. Now consider that. The purpose of branding someone, or something, is to offer clarity or proof of ownership. Even if you don't understand what the brand means, you are intended to be able to see it in plain terms. But this is ambiguous. A brand is specifically intended to extract ambiguity from the equation, not add it. So if this brand was applied in a manner intentionally flaunting ambiguity of ownership, then the most likely reason is that the ownership in question is fictional. Sherry is never sexually assaulted. She's never taken anywhere. Nobody comes for her. She isn't farmed out as a prostitute or anything similar. It's not sex trafficking. There isn't any reason to brand her. She's being held alone. There's nobody else present from which she would need to be distinguished. Sherry tells law enforcement that she was beaten repeatedly, and her husband offers us the notion that she had black and yellow bruises on her face and body as a result of ongoing beatings throughout her confinement. But do they ever find DNA from two women on her body? No. We're told DNA from one man and one woman are found on her. So, many people find it difficult to believe Sherry would do this to herself. But as I've said, she's the real perpetrator in this crime. The other elements are fictional. The physical beating we see on her body is the manifestation of the emotional beating she was suffering while imprisoned with this irreconcilable issue. Just look at the emotional implications present within her choices here. Her emotional issue stems from her confinement in a life where she must let go of being the free younger woman to become the aging confined older woman. Half of that consideration involves being confined in a life where marriage and kids steal the freedom and adventure afforded her younger self, while the other half of that consideration involves theft of her physical beauty by her older self. So when she learns the lesson about choosing what she needs instead of what she wants, she finally realizes she must return to being confined in that married life with kids. That happens instantaneously upon her arrival back in the old world. Therefore, she doesn't have to represent it as a manifestation of emotion. It's real. But we don't age significantly overnight. Physical beauty is stolen through time. So she will need to represent the decline or loss of physical beauty, but also do it in a manner intended to legitimize the fabricated story about the kidnapping. Accordingly, we get the broken nose, chopped off hair, emaciation, bruises, branding, and abrasions contributing to one idea: loss or decline of physical beauty. We learn Sherry was treated and released the same day, and that her husband is the only source we have to verify the severity of his wife's physical damage. So is he exaggerating what happened? And why do some people think he's involved? Now, if we look back at Sherry's past, again, we have precedence for her fabricating stories about other people hurting her. She even did it to her mother. So, it's fair to say Sherry was always this person, at least to a certain extent. She and Keith certainly weren't married back then. We could say he knew about this. He knew she was like this. In truth, I'd guarantee he knows exactly who she is and was chosen as her partner for his willingness to accommodate the faulty logic. In the same way you and I would seek a significant other whose traits accommodate our own behaviors, quirks, and other such considerations, mentally ill people do the same. Josh Powell is a great example. His father taught him to have zero respect for women as romantic partners and to bully them into what he wanted them to do through persistent training. If one didn't comply, that was the wrong woman, and he would then need to move on to somebody who'd do whatever he instructed. Josh dated a young woman named Catherine and lured her into his web of sociopathy to an extent she finally put on the brakes and wouldn't allow greater control over her. So they broke up, and he found Susan, who remained loyal under any and all circumstances, even beyond reason, until it finally killed her. So that explains some of what we see in this tale. Sherry's phone is found face up on the side of the road, with the earbuds neatly coiled on top, to offer Keith the subtext suggesting she's going to come back. It's why she's preserving the items. Keith has never questioned the validity of Sherry's story, despite the faulty logic. And that's why he's her husband. He accommodates the sociopathy, the illness, no matter what. When you marry someone, your expectation is not only that that person will accept you for who you are, but that the person will also have your back, no matter what. So, when Sherry tells law enforcement that a fight with one of her captors resulted in a bad cut on her foot, the photos subsequently taken of that foot show no such thing. She's also able to run in her bare feet in this condition. So, the cut never happened. Sherry can't seem to validate or even elaborate upon the circumstances of her captivity. There are so many holes in her story, one would have to wonder how Keith simply accepts it for what she says it is when it appears as though Sherry was leaving him and the kids in the dust. It can only be because he's always known that's who she is. Further proof of that, and of Sherry's true identity, lies in the following information. Apparently, between the years 2000 and 2003, multiple members of Sherry's family contacted police in relation to her odd, even criminal behavior. Her dad, Richard, suggested that Sherry burglarized his home during that time, and 3 years after that occasion, he caught her making withdrawals from his checking account in the absence of his approval. Her sister Sheila said that back in the year 2000, someone kicked in her back door at home. She believed it was Sherry. Look at the history of Sherry doing anything the hell she wants without regard for the people who love her. She assigns herself a level of freedom and autonomy that's entirely unrealistic. In fact, it's criminal. And her family becomes the victim. So, I don't think it's any coincidence that she pulls this stunt with no regard for her family. She's never had any to begin with. If you examine the incident with her mother and the false accusation of self-harm, or stealing from her dad, or even breaking in the door at her sister's home, what's the common element present? Broken trust in relation to family. Sherry's family members could not trust her. And why? She afforded herself a level of autonomy with them that indulged criminality. The fabricated abduction is no different. She was going to run away. But Sherry had chosen a man who would take her back without questioning truth. Again, when it comes to significant others, we look for those who complete us somehow. If our behavior is dictated by untreated and even unrecognized mental illness, then the partner we choose in order to succeed in marriage must accommodate. Law enforcement claims Keith Papini might have endangered the investigation by releasing the details to the public. But Keith knows that nothing is being compromised. His only goal is to legitimize Sherry's story. There really are no kidnappers, and therefore, there's not actually an investigation that could be hampered by his actions. He's doing what he's always done, which is validating his wife's faulty logic in order to keep up appearances. He should be getting her help, but instead, he's accommodating the mental illness. And that's what Sherry's always wanted. In fact, it probably has a lot to do with the reason why she returned. In the end, there is no resolution to this case, and Sherry has become reclusive. She has not spoken publicly about the abduction, and I assume never will, because it's a lie. That's the only vulnerability she's protecting here. It isn't about the victim's right to privacy. I believe she fabricated the abduction to run off with a man, changed her mind soon after, and then went into isolation as the man left to return from the place from which he came. In isolation, she inflicted injuries necessary to return believably. Only Keith tells us her nose was broken. Only Keith speaks about the severe bruising or even the weight loss. All of this confirmation comes from Keith Papini, who accommodates her. And the rest is history. Sometimes a protagonist comes home to what they need, having learned the lesson that what they want can't be reconciled within reality. Sometimes our dreams have truly passed us by. Sherry couldn't get younger, or more beautiful, or even regain the lost freedom. But she could make her escape from that emotional issue by returning home. The people who love her, Keith and the kids, were waiting right there for her to arrive. But Sherry ran away because of something that none of us can ever escape. We only live once. We're only young once. Free once. Beautiful once. It all ends someday. So it's probably no surprise that when Sherry was allegedly released from captivity after the abduction and was 150 miles from her home, it was not only in Yolo County, spelled just like the acronym, but also occurred in the town called Yolo. You only live once. That theme drove her to run away and also to return home. While you and I may not employ similar methods in our own lives, we are all still that person, being pulled helplessly toward the future while running away back into the past, never quite finding that place called home where things don't have to change. we're imprisoned by the moment, caught in a purgatory between what was and what will be. We never escape that until death. We're trapped, isolated, shackled, stuck in a dark, lonely place, positioned between our younger self and older self. And every time we try to answer the question, who am I? The moment is so fleeting, the truth changes once again, before it even arrives. We reach desperately to grab it, to seize control, to find meaning, but it always slips away, until it's gone forever. The folly of trying to fight the wrath of time and mortality is that you have to run from inevitable darkness despite your desires, which means you're still running toward it in your ignorance. But if you accept that darkness surrounds us and that your only recourse is to light the path ahead, your love illuminates the truth. Sherry managed to do that before it was too late. She returned to those she loved. And the secret to life, to who we are, is revealed in the process. We are not the person we see in the mirror every day. We are not our younger selves, or even our older selves. We don't get to define who we are. Others do that job for us. Sherry was a mom, a wife, a daughter, a sister. We are nothing more than the hope we offer. Every label we give ourselves that's absent of love isn't the truth. It's something we fabricated to hide behind a crumbling facade of identity. Your job title, the type of car you own, the clothing brand you wear. It's all a disguise. In this life, we need not be anything permanent. There is nothing we can sustain except love. At the end of the day, all we have in this strange world is each other. Once Sherry realized that and internalized the lesson, she found her way home. The right place to be is neither here nor there. Not your younger self or even the older one. Light is always moving. It's not a product of the past or the future. It happens now. That is all we are. This moment. Light moving in the direction of darkness. So if there's only one question that can offer us our purpose in its answer, it's this. What will you do to shine? That decision is who you are. But it always changes. So let go of the past, run toward the future, and illuminate your truth along the way.